like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Dr. Temple Grandin, the professor, author, consultant, subject of the HBO film, and renowned expert on autism, who, of course, is artistic herself. And actually, today's interview won't be live so much as Memrex. That is, I recorded this conversation with Grandin earlier this month when I interviewed her in front of 1,200 people at the Paramount Theater in Austin. Echoing the format when I held a similar conversation at the Paramount 4 years ago, I asked Grandin questions on my own devising and then periodically incorporated queries that we invited folks to submit for her through the Paramount's website. Afterwards, we held a Q&A, welcoming questions from audience members posed directly to Grandin, in which I moderated. We'll hear some of that session in the latter part of the interview itself on next week's show. As for today's portion, I should note a couple of points, including that before the interview, Grandin's 92-year-old mother, Eustacia Cutler, spoke for a while via Skype in a session I found both striking and revelatory. Also, particularly in today's portion of the Grandin interview, there really isn't all that much that's animal-related. Rather, it really deals chiefly with all kinds of questions and issues having to do with autism, from what to do when someone on the spectrum is or isn't diagnosed, to how accurately the HBO film depicted how Grandin thinks in pictures, and much more. Later in the show, in addition to the usual elements, I plan to play an older eel song, an animal song by an animal band, if you will, and even if you won't. Sorry, just juggling a few things here. So right now, though, let's get to the interview with Temple Grandin, expertly recorded by the talented Dustin Zvalok on February 1st at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. This is Dr. Temple Grandin on Talking Animals on WMNF. Dr. Grandin, it's an honor once again to speak with you and look forward to covering ground that we might have covered 4 years ago, but hopefully some stuff that we didn't get a chance to talk about
great.
As well. So for many families, perhaps including many in this theater, a major challenge is arriving at a diagnosis of a child on the spectrum and what to do upon that diagnosis. So let's say, just hypothetically, somewhere out there are the parents of a 3 or 4 year old son whose behavior and communication has them concerned, including that this little boy isn't talking yet. What's their first step?
Well, the first step is you've got to start working with the child. When I was 4 years old, I was in a really good speech therapy program. You've got to teach the child to talk. Another thing you have to teach them is turn-taking, how to learn to wait and take turns at games. And my speech teacher would say a word like cup, and then she'd go cuppa and say it slowly. But you need to spend a lot of hours interacting with these kids. The worst thing you could do with a 4-year-old that's not talking, regardless of the diagnosis, is just let them play with a phone all day. That's what you don't want to do. You've got to get engagement with people. Early intervention is essential. Another thing I want to say about autism is when kids are little, when they're 4, I looked completely terrible when I was 4. And some of the kids, you get them talking, and autism ranges from half of the programmers in Silicon Valley, I'm absolutely serious, to somebody who can't dress themselves. And when they changed the guidelines in 2013, they took out the Asperger's, which is basically socially awkward with no speech delay. Now you have this huge, huge spectrum with so many different kinds of people in it. And I think that can be a real problem.
Sure. I want to talk a few different ways about the spectrum and what that means. But back to the kid who, this hypothetical kid I just sort of created. So if he's not speaking and the parents are concerned, do they take him to their pediatrician? Or if they think maybe this is something more along the lines of autism, do they go right to a specialist?
If you've got a kid that's not talking, I don't care what the diagnosis is, the kind of therapy you do is really somewhere. You got to start working with that kid now. Always give them an opportunity to use their words. A lot of these kids are like a phone on one bar. It's a slow processing speed. You got to give them time to respond. And there's basically 3 ways that language can be messed up, regardless of the label. auditory processing. When the adults talked really fast, it went into gibberish, like blah, 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 blah. And this is one of the reasons why you have to slow down. I was not hearing hard consonants. I also had problems with getting speech out. And then another kind of problem is echolalia. They'll yak out an entire movie script, but they don't know what it means. So what you have to do there is start working that movie script into the real world. So that's the three ways the brain can be messed up on speech.
Yeah.
And you got to start working with these kids now. And I have a book, The Way I See It. There's a few other books you can get. And if there's no services, you get some grandmothers to start working with the kid now. Don't
wow.
wait. You okay. already got a diagnosis. He doesn't talk.
Right.
And his behavior is probably really weird.
Okay. So this kid then, let's say he is diagnosed. Sounds like he is diagnosed by you right now. So what would you say, besides taking him to grandma, having him really work on the speech, what are two or three other very important things once we've identified
once we got the
kid,
speech, yeah. you can have sensory sensitivity, like sensitivity to loud noise. I couldn't stand balloons popping. And one of the best ways to deal with that is let the child control it. Like maybe you blow up a balloon just this big and then I pop it. Or if he doesn't like the vacuum cleaner, let the child play with the vacuum cleaner where they can control it and turn that vacuum cleaner on and off. And sometimes when they control it, they can get somewhat desensitized.
So you just get acclimated
by
their own hand.
But they
yeah.
need to control it. Okay, some kids are wearing headphones. Now the problem is if you wear a headphone all the time, the ear is going to get more sensitive. So it's okay to have a headphone with you all the time. That's fine. But try not to wear it. Again, giving them control. And then there's a few super loud places, bathrooms and all kinds of automated stuff. Yes, you put it on for that. Then when you come out, you know, try to take it off.
What are some common pitfalls that well-meaning parents that are find themselves in the situation that we're discussing, they don't know what to do and they're sort of just
well, the
proceeding the best they
I'm
can.
Well, the biggest problem I'm saying is they're not, you know, challenging the kid enough. You got to stretch these kids. You don't throw them in the deep end of the pool, but give them a choice of two different activities. When I was a teenager and I was really anxious and didn't want to go to my aunt's ranch, mother gave me a choice. I could go for a week, I could go all summer. Not going wasn't one of the choices. But I'm seeing too many kids, fully verbal, smart kids that maybe ought to get high-level jobs that aren't learning basic skills, like walk up to the counter and order the food at a restaurant, shopping, just basic things like this. Things that I was doing at 8 and 9 years old, you know, I'm seeing 16-year-olds that have never shopped by themselves. Mm. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, I think one of Temple Grandin's commandments is, thou shalt not coddle your autistic kid. And another that this ties into maybe more is thou shalt not allow the kid to become a recluse. Right.
No,
so the thing is get them out.
Absolutely and wasn't allowed to become a recluse. I mean, I had to be out doing things with the family. But I'm seeing kids just holing up in their room and playing video games for 8 hours a day, and they're not having good outcomes. They're not getting jobs, they're not learning programming or anything else useful. And you just can't let that happen. The other big problem I'm seeing, especially with fully verbal kids, is not learning how to work. You say, and my mother talked earlier, and when I went away to boarding school for the first 2 years, they had me run the horse barn, and I was learning how to work. This is really important. We need to have a gradual transition from the world of school to the world of work. Ideally, I'd like to see things like church volunteer jobs at age 11, walking dogs for the neighbors, where they start learning how to do a task outside the family on a schedule. And then as soon as they're legal, real jobs. Now again, don't throw them in the deep end of the pool. Don't put them into some clothing store during Christmas rush. Don't do that. But
that might not work. Yeah.
Because multitasking can be an issue. You know, too much multitasking, that can be an issue.
Yeah. But again, your thing is do not go on the other end. Don't
but I am seeing all these grandparents coming up to me, and they're finding out they were on the spectrum when the kids get diagnosed, and they had a paper route at age 11. And then they were working as an engineer or an accountant or maybe even in sales.
Yeah.
They had decent jobs.
Well, one thing I was really struck by, I had the chance to see your mom do the,
yes,
the Skype thing.
That's right.
And I understand even more from seeing her at 92, I think, Skyping and talking about all the things that she learned and did and had you do. And she was clearly studied up and obviously was very smart about her approach. She just found a way to get you to do things. If people put up barriers at those schools, she found a way to negotiate.
Well, she had a really good sense on how to stretch me. Another thing that she mentioned in her talk is there's just too much medical model right now. It sort of is getting over medical modeled. See, a lot of the things that mother figured out were just things in the neighborhood. One of the things that all kids did in our neighborhood was when the parents had parties. When kids were 7 and 8 years old, they had to put on their good clothes and be hostesses and hosts at parties and pass around the snacks, shake hands with the guests. Social skills in the 50s and 60s were taught in a much more structured way. See, an autistic kid has got to learn those social skills like they're in a foreign country. Has to be instructed. And she just had a very good sense. She also encouraged my art skill. I was good at art. That showed up in third grade. She had me doing lots of different kinds of art. Kids on the spectrum will have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. And for me, it was art. Maybe another little kid, it's mathematics. Well, then give them the harder math book. Build on the area of strength.
And on the things where you are uneven and other kids are uneven, on the things they're not so solid at, how vigorously do you get them to try to work on bringing those up?
The way I look at it is you got to get reading up at least to the sixth grade level in the mathematician, or you can't function. Us visual thinkers, who are very good at things like skilled trades, industrial design, art, graphic design, and photography, we absolutely can't do algebra. And I'm seeing algebra preventing kids from going into a skilled trade, which is ridiculous. So how did I get out of it? Mother explained in her talk that they did waive the entrance exam, but they didn't waive the math requirement. The math requirement in 67, this is a quirk in the educational system that was very important for me, was finite math, which was a lot of statistics and probability, and that was more visual. That was the required class for the whole country in 67. That saved me on getting through the math requirement. But we have a gigantic shortage in this country right now of high-end skilled trades like electricians, plumbers, metal workers, airplane mechanics, car mechanics, truck mechanics, and welders. And I worked for every major meat company, major big metal construction stuff. And the people that do that kind of high-end metal work, they're all retiring. They can't replace them because the kids that ought to be replacing them are playing video games in the basement and can't pass algebra.
We're listening to an interview with Dr. Temple Grandin that recorded at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas earlier this month. And we're going to hear the next part momentarily. Just want to let you know that WNF will bring you special live coverage of the Michael Cohen hearings this morning, beginning at 11:06, just after the NPR News headlines, right here on 88.5 WMNF. So let's carry on with the next part of our interview with Dr. Grandin. And we talked a little bit about this backstage afterwards, but one thing I was very struck by that your mom pointed out in her talk was that schools, like a school that you went to when you were younger, and ASU, both had waived certain requirements to allow you to attend. It was a private school, I think, a Country Day private school when you were younger.
Well, sixth grade math I was fine on. See, where I hit a wall was algebra, and they never jumped me to geometry. Because what I'm finding right now, I'm talking to a lot of people that are visual thinkers like me, that think in photorealistic pictures, they can sometimes do geometry. I never even got a chance to try geometry. They just kept pounding away on algebra.
Right. But I guess what concerned me is that those schools were no longer willing to waive any sort of requirement for an autistic person so that that school would not
I think it's a real problem because the visual thinkers can't do algebra. I'm seeing this pattern over and over again. And now you do have to have your up to old-fashioned sixth-grade math, like find the area of a circle. I've designed hydraulic and pneumatic equipment. You do have to know how to find the area of a circle. To do that and subtract the area of one circle from the area of another circle for your cylinders and rods. And that is something, you know, I had no problems with doing that. But we're screening a lot of kids out. And I've said to parents, what do? I think you're going to have to go in the back door. Like, get a job on a construction site, especially one that's a family-owned construction company, and just sort of go in the back door and learn the trade.
Right.
That's what you're going to have to do.
But I just think whether people that had your skills or not, the fact that these schools are not more open and welcoming to autistic people and finding a way for them to
it's
be
It's not
sort
just
of,
the autistic people. I mean, it's the ADHD, it's the dyslexics.
Right, but,
and the other problem for a lot of these kids is video games are really addictive
right.
in a way that they aren't for other kids.
Yeah. Well, I have a son who I think might have that problem.
No,
but that's
we got to control
that. That's another conversation
because
for another
what
time.
I'm seeing yeah. bad outcomes.
Yeah.
I'm having parents come up to me. He's 22. He's holed up in the basement playing video games. And not doing anything else.
Yeah.
And he ought to be out fixing airplanes or trucks. And these are good jobs that are not going to go away. I've been following very carefully what computers are going to take over. And they're going to take over some high-end knowledge jobs, like doctor diagnosis for cancer. That'll be done by computers. Reading x-rays done by computers. Frontline jobs like pediatrician, nurses, teachers, those jobs aren't going away. And the high-end skilled trades are... They're not going to be done by computers anytime soon.
Yeah. I'm just concerned that someone, even if they're not the next Temple Grandin, if they're somebody who could be quite accomplished, if they can't get a leg up in a way that you did. This is a problem. Yeah.
I know. I was just down at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association trade show, and I know a guy. He's showing some stuff there. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but he stutters very badly, probably autistic, dyslexic, some ADHD, horrible student. But they let him take the welding class. He now owns a big metal fabrication company, and I was touching his stuff the other day.
Yeah.
Just the other day.
Right.
And this, but you see what's happening now, and I've seen this happen in California and some other states, is a kid can't pass algebra, so they're making him take 5 algebra classes, and if they have a welding, he doesn't have a chance to take it. And then fortunately here in Texas, they're putting skilled trades back in. But you do not need algebra for skilled trades.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. It just seems odd that there's more rigidity.
Oh, it's very rigid.
Right, but then you're boxing people out from opportunities like the gentleman you
mentioned.
But
this is the thing that makes me absolutely crazy as I go back and forth between the autism world, the educator world, and then I'm at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association trade show. Then last year, I went through two huge, brand new, gigantic pork processing plants. And by the time I got through the second one, I was about ready to cry because we don't make the specialized equipment anymore. You can't buy American because it doesn't exist.
Hmm.
I'm serious. It doesn't exist. And the reason for that is these kids that are different. I work with lots of autistic, dyslexic metal workers. They don't get an opportunity to go into a shop and make stuff out of metal. And the very clever, like I saw a robotic arm in this shop. And... An original thing to do with a robotic arm is to make up a totally new tool to put on the end that doesn't do the job like a person does. Or you can just stick a regular tool on the end of it. That's not very creative. No, there was very clever mechanical engineering in this plant, and it came from French Quebec, and it came from Europe. And yes, we make the cold room doors. Yep, clunky, too expensive to ship. Yes, we built the building. But the very clever specialized equipment... We're not making any more. I was about ready to cry by the time I got through the second plant.
You're making me start to cry.
This was
December
2017, just over a year ago I was there. This is recent.
Wow. All right. Well, let's maybe shift gears and maybe we'll come back to some of this. But let me ask one of the questions that came in through the website. This one says, as a mother of a six-year-old boy, I have a bright, funny, charming, engaging son on the spectrum who gets very aggressive quickly. He's aggressive when he's anxious, when he's angry, when he faces new things. What do we do to help him? We've tried play therapy, occupational therapy, social skills, yoga, mindfulness, and we're running out of ideas. He's 6 and very intense.
Well, as Mother talked about, she and my third grade teacher work together as a team. They have very consistent rules between home and school. A temper tantrum at school was no television for one night. And if I had one at school, Mrs. Deitch would call my mother. And then if I was having a lot of problems at home, Mother talked to Mrs. Deitch. Absolute consistency between home and school. And when I was pitching a great big fit, they didn't go, I got to take the TV away. They waited until I got all nice and calm, and they would just say, you know the rules. You can join the family now, but there'll be no television for tonight. And they'd take it away for one night. Just very consistently applied. And that worked for me.
So you think that, in this case,
and has to be completely consistent. Because I've seen kids where their behavior's good at school and horrible at home, or their behavior's wonderful at home and their behavior's awful at school. Because the rules are not the same in both places. Parents and teachers have got to work together as a team. And that's something that mother and my elementary school did.
Yeah, and again, what your mom was talking about in that thing, this was obviously a number of years ago, and that time, in many ways, seemed more progressive by the way she was describing it and some of the policies and the way the schools respond.
Well, things have
now
gotten too much medical model. I like to bust up the medical model. I'm going to do medical model on a mechanical problem on one of my flights one time. It was a Delta Airlines flight. And they had this, was delayed. We were getting ready to board, and the pilot didn't like something on walk around. And they found out that this plane had a microbleed in the anterior proximal rotary appendage. Doesn't that sound stupid? You know, proximal? Proximal's here. Distal would be the wheel. It had a little hydraulic leak. I watched three mechanics have meetings around this plane, around the front wheel. And then the final mechanic with his pristine safety vest climbed up the ladder, took the aviation illumination probe and flashed it around inside the wheel compartment. He comes down, did not move the ladder. She was grounded. I knew she was grounded before they made the announcement.
Wow.
I got to watch the whole thing out the window.
Yeah.
But when I talk about that with medical model, it seems kind of stupid. I think we need to bust up some of this medical model. I think it's better to use medical model for airplanes.
Well, this sounds like it was a real bad one. Yeah.
Yeah. But I got together with a medical friend of mine, and we, like, gave this plane a proper medical diagnosis with correct anatomical terms.
Well, all right. So speaking of medical-related things, what is your overall position on medication for autistic folks?
Young kids, you need to be very conservative with medication. The younger the brain, the more conservative you need to be. Now, I've been on antidepressants since 1980. Went on them in my early 30s, because as I went through my 20s, my panic attacks and anxiety worsened. I don't think I'd be here today without medication. I worked with other visual thinkers that were very good designers, one that was, I think, autistic, the other two that were not, that were on Prozac, and they'd be on drugs and alcohol otherwise. I describe my experiences with medication in my book, Thinking and Pictures. The mistake that's made with antidepressants is too high a dose. The label doses are too high. If you take too high a dose, you get agitation and insomnia. Another basic principle with the medication is it should have some wow factor. Like, wow, this really works. There's way too many powerful antipsychotics given out, like candy, which have very, very bad neurological effects. Little kids, I want to try to avoid medication. But there are some, I started taking it as an adult, it saved me. And in the HBO movie, I was eating yogurt and Jell-O. I had uncontrollable colitis. Everything went through me. And when I went on the antidepressants, it stopped the constant fear. My fear system, my nervous system was all ramped up. And the colitis almost was cured.
But were you on any meds as a younger person?
No, not really, no.
So it was only when you went on the
I went
Prozac
on it later on.
Yeah.
But I've seen little kids like on 6 or 7 different meds. That's just disgusting. Absolutely disgusting.
So generally, anti-meds for a kid?
Little kids, I want to try to avoid medication if possible.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, a lot of this is done, there's no logic to it. Okay, the younger the brain, the more careful you have to be. Because if you take a med, it can affect how the brain grows. And I was an adult when I went on it. I don't think I would be here now without it, because I was completely falling apart physically from stress-related health problems. And the other three designers I worked with would have been in the gutter on drugs and alcohol if they weren't on low-dose Prozac. And when we did the HBO movie, I talked to a person at the Emmy party about a very famous director that wouldn't be functional without Prozac, and I will not say who it is.
Even if I ask a few more times?
No, I will not tell you who it is. I will keep that.
But the
other thing you gotta do is lots of exercise. I do 100 sit-ups every night. I hate every one of them. And if I didn't do them, I wouldn't be able to sleep.
Yeah, I remember, at least when you're on the road, which you are a lot, you're doing them in the hotel room, I think, right off the bat.
I do them in the hotel on the bed. I had to have something I could do in a hotel easily.
So in your case, the stress accelerated as you got towards adulthood and beyond.
Oh, it got worse.
Yeah.
And you see, the thing with the anxiety, and I found out my fear center in my brain was 3 times bigger. But I want to emphasize that's not true for everybody. Seems like us visual thinkers and some of the mathematical thinkers are more nervous than some of the kids that are the word thinkers that love history and memorize tons and tons of facts. In my book, The Autistic Brain, I discuss the different kinds of thinkers. Photorealistic visual thinker, pattern mathematical thinker, and the word thinker. And there is scientific research that backs up what I'm saying on this, and the references are in the autistic brain.
This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm playing back the interview I recorded earlier this month with Dr. Temple Grandin at the Paramount Theater in Austin. We're hearing a portion of the interview on today's show, and we'll hear the other portion on next week's show. Let's continue now with the interview with Dr. Temple Grandin. So this might bring us to another question that was submitted through the website. This one says, what moments during therapy sessions as a child did you find most impactful? What advice can you give to occupational therapists and other professionals working with kids with autism to become better clinicians?
Well, let's use engineering terminology because I'm trying to break up the medical model. In engineering, it's called troubleshooting. And one of the biggest problems I see, whether you're figuring out a problem with a horse or a dog or a kid with autism, is overgeneralization. Teachers will say to me, what do I do about kids with autism in the classroom? Well, I don't even know the age. Because for three-year-olds and little kids, I can give you pretty general information on what to do. But as they get older, I've got to know, what is the problem? Is he having problems with noise sensitivity, tantrums in the classroom, can't read? What exactly is the problem? Another very big problem is bullying, teasing. And fortunately, in my beautiful little elementary school, I managed to get through elementary school without being bullied because Mrs. Deitch explained to the other children, and mother talked about that in her talks, that I had a disability, but it wasn't visible, like a wheelchair or crutches, and that the other children need to help me. But high school was a nightmare of teasing. And the only places I was not bullied was the specialized interests, like horseback riding, model rockets, and electronics. You know, for another kid, it might be theater. That's another great field that's not going to get replaced by computers. I think people are not going to want to watch computers at theater.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
But getting the kid involved in shared interests. It could be scouting. It could be band. It could be theater, it could be a chess club, it could be a lot of different things.
And when you're talking about the situation in school, it again reminds me of what your mom said just earlier in this Skype presentation about how you went to a school that was local, so it was kids that you grew up
with.
And knew you. And again, so the fact that that very same school now does not admit anybody on the spectrum, I just found that outrageous.
Well, it's a problem. The other thing, to get at the discussion about public versus private, well, I'm going to use an engineering term again. It's site-specific. And what that means is at one school, the kid's doing great. Then you go over to another school in another district or something, and it's terrible.
Right.
It's very, very much about the particular place. But if I'm just going to go across the board on the fully verbal kids, the biggest problem I'm seeing is not learning skills. Money, shopping, driving. Driving's going to take longer. I was really lucky that on my aunt's ranch, the mailbox was 3 miles away. So that gave me 6 miles a day, 36 miles a week of driving practice with no traffic. They need to do a longer period of time of practice with very little traffic so that driving the car goes into motor memory. Very important before you start doing traffic. And if I hadn't learned to drive, I wouldn't have been able to have done any of my livestock stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, learning how
is
to drive
critical?
Is essential.
Yeah. Thinking about skills and development, it makes me think of Mr. Carlock in a way.
Oh, I had some great teachers. He got me interested in studying by giving me interesting projects.
Yeah, let me just say for people who may not know that are listening.
Yeah.
So he was a pivotal figure in her life and a mentor. He was a science teacher, but it went well
high
beyond that.
Science
he was
teacher.
A fundamental presence and mentor.
Absolutely.
So can you talk about what he did for you beyond what I just mentioned and the importance, more to the point maybe, of mentors for
autistic
kids?
Well, mentors are extremely important. I mean, my mother, of course, was one of the really important mentors, my third grade teacher. And then Mr. Carlock, when he came in after I'd been taking care of the horse barn for a number of years, and he gave me interesting projects to do. and by giving me interesting projects to do, then I got interested in the goal of becoming a scientist. So I knuckled down and I started to study. When studying became a pathway to a goal, I think that's a very important thing. And then I studied. The other thing that was good is that Hampshire Country School, where I went to boarding school, and Franklin Pierce College are right 5 miles apart. So I was still seeing Mr. Carlock on the weekends. So that helped the transition into college. I had a lot of social problems in college, but the one problem I didn't have was things like losing homework, not getting up in the morning, what they now use the medical term executive function. And I think one of the reasons why I didn't have those problems was because in the 50s they pounded in, be on time for meals.
Yeah.
I was taught to lay my clothes out the night before. I still do that now.
Oh, yeah?
I still do that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll put the shirt I'm going to wear tomorrow, I hang it on the desk chair in the hotel room.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that we did this interview like this 4 years ago, interviewed you a number of times on the radio show and certainly read about you and studied and whatever, but I think I might have gotten almost more than any of that of just listening to your mom tonight, because I thought, now I think I really get a big reason why Temple Grandin is Temple Grandin. I mean, she was no nonsense, but
that's
super
right.
Smart, and she just figured out what to do. When there back then, there was obviously very little
but
to draw.
But she just used a lot of common sense. She had a very good sense of stretching me,
yeah.
Of not throwing me in the deep end of the pool, but
right.
Stretch me. She gave me choices of things to do. And even when I got thrown out of ninth grade for fighting, mother had been working as a journalist with kids with everything was called emotional disturbance then, emotionally disturbed kids, and did a PBS documentary on mental retardation. And she'd been to every special school in New England. So she picked out three schools and she gave me a choice. She was stretching, but there was always choices. And I think some of it's just 50s common sense too. Because I'll suggest to a parent something like, maybe your 12-year-old needs to walk dogs for the neighbors. And I had a mom say to me, our school doesn't have a program for that. I go, really? You just set it up with the neighbors.
That's crazy talk now. Yeah. Okay. So what are some recommendations that might help an autistic child or the parent of one identify an ideal mentor looking for their Mr. Carlock?
Well, sometimes mentors kind of, you know, find the kid, too. You know, if a teacher sees math talent in a kid, they'll mentor it. I was just up in Crookstone, Minnesota, and before they had this cold wave, and I was talking to some people there, and at one of the local high schools, a science teacher gave a kid on the spectrum an astrophysics book, and he became one. Well, this brings up the important thing of exposing kids to different things. There's some really bad stuff going on in some schools where they think all the kids should be the same. Everyone should just do the fourth grade math book. Well, maybe the kid's bored stiff with that, and that's why he's a behavior problem. Let's give him a high school math book if he can do it. And they'll give me all kinds of stupid reasons why they can't do that. I said, I can probably find that book for free in somebody's attic or pick it up on Amazon for $9 or $10. You know, there's no reason for not doing it.
Yeah.
But if you don't expose the kid to the book, he's not going to know whether he could do it or not. I mean, an astrophysics book, I could either use it for doorstop. I don't think I'd do that because I'd want to give it to the right kid that could make
yeah.
use of it.
And that happened. And that
it's clicked. Not me.
And that, yeah. And that,
yeah.
It's
not me.
Yeah. So this may hook into this. This is another question that came through the website. What is one thing you would want to tell a new teacher who will be teaching students with autism for the first time?
I want to know an age range here again. Is she doing with little kids? I just did an education conference just the other day, and they had teachers doing kindergarten and teachers doing sixth grade.
Well, let's take a elementary, let's say fourth to sixth grade.
Fourth to sixth,
and then,
okay.
Let's take a junior high.
No, okay, just elementary, but not the real little tiny ones.
Okay.
One of the things is avoid long strings of verbal information. Working memory is a problem for our kids with a lot of different labels. So any task that involves a sequence, give them a pilot's checklist. Step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4. And so they can see that checklist, just two or three words for each item. Also, no surprises. Let's say there's going to be some change. They're going to do construction or something at the school. You want to warn the kid about it. Try to avoid surprises. Have it clear what they're supposed to do. But long strings of verbal information just doesn't work with these, with a lot of these kids.
This is Talking Animals on WMNF. We're hearing an interview with Dr. Temple Grandin that I recorded earlier this month at the Paramount Theater in Austin. And we're going to hear one more portion today, and then we'll hear the balance of the interview, perhaps including the audience Q&A next week on next week's edition of Talking Animals. And also just to let you know, if you didn't hear this earlier, that WMNF will bring you special live coverage of the Michael Cohen hearings this morning, beginning at 11:06, so just after Talking Animals here on 88.5 FM WMNF. So let's hear our final portion for today of the interview with Dr. Temple Grandin at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas.
We've mentioned a couple times the HBO movie Temple Grandin, which actually was made, I looked this up, about 9 years ago today, almost to the day. February 6th was the release date.
That's right. Yeah.
So we're almost exactly
at
9 years.
9 years, that's
yeah.
Right.
Generated tremendous acclaim, won several Emmys, including Outstanding Made for Television Movie, and much of the film was shot in Austin.
It was shot right here.
Yeah.
I remember those signs at the airport. We got to keep Austin weird.
So a couple of weeks ago, I noticed that it was airing that night on HBO. So I thought, well, heck, I'm interviewing Dr. Grandin at the Paramount in a couple of weeks. Maybe I should rewatch the film. And I loved it again for the same and different reasons, including the way it really seemed to present a sense of how your visual thinking
works. Oh, it presented visual thinking absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
There's two scenes in there, one where a whole bunch of different horses come up and one where a whole bunch of different shoes come up. That's exactly how I think. It showed that completely accurately. It also showed some of the sensory problems with noise and things like that. And the projects, like the squeeze machine, the optical illusion room, the gate, and the dip vat, I actually did all those projects. Those projects are accurate.
Yeah. No, it was really well done. And but there was a number of other things where somebody would say something, you'd be having a conversation, and the you would see your depiction of it.
That's
and
right.
I thought, wow,
visual thinking was shown accurately. And that was Mick Jackson, the director. He's a visual thinker, and he understood how to do that.
Yeah. So, again, not counting the film, but including that as well, I mean, you're famously thinking in pictures person. But what I've never been clear on this over the years is, how common is this amongst those with autism? Does everyone think in pictures to some degree?
Everybody with autism doesn't think in pictures. And when I wrote Thinking in Pictures originally, I made the mistake of thinking that everyone on the spectrum thought in pictures. Now, the thing that's universal, the working memory problems, I think, go across the whole spectrum. But the whole uneven skills, good at one thing, bad at something else. So I am what's called an object visualizer. And that was shown really well in the movie. Then you have the more mathematical mind. It's a visual spatial pattern thinker. Well, you want to see some great patterns. Let's expose the kid to science and nature and the stuff they're doing now, material science. Now look at some of the pictures of the molecules. They're beautiful geometric patterns. That's something that the pattern thinker, mathematical pattern thinker, can relate to. And then you got the word guy. They tend to love history or they love sports statistics, memorizing all kinds of verbal facts. So there's kind of three different kinds of specialized minds.
And are those three different kinds vary with where someone is on the spectrum, or does that have nothing to do with
well,
that?
Well, really? I'm all I'm going to say is that it's on the verbal end, fully verbal end of the spectrum.
Right. If you think in pictures as you do, is there any correlation with where they are on the spectrum?
Well, I'm going to put it on the spectrum as where they are in terms of verbal development.
Okay.
And I'm talking about people that are fully verbal. Now, if you're working with individuals that don't learn how to talk, there's some really good books to get that are written by people that look really severe, can't control their movements. One is The Reason I Jump, and then the sequel to The Reason I Jump, which I think is actually a better book than the first one. There's Tito's How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move, which will be on the book table. Yes, and we are selling books afterwards.
And signing them, I believe, too.
I will be signing them.
Yeah.
But the people that are nonverbal describe how huge amounts of effort are required to screen out background noise, how they can't control their body movements. Also, they can only use one sense at a time. Seeing and hearing is jumbled up like a pixelating TV on a really bad satellite dish.
When you were talking about the verbal guy, I think as you called him, when we saw the HBO film, I thought about something that I've found kind of vexing about you, which is, again, you think in pictures, and therefore, as far as I know, do not really think in words or in verbal language as much. So how is it that you have become an accomplished, prolific writer when that's not necessarily...
Words narrate the pictures. Like if I'm writing something about, you know, how to handle cattle, like where to stand, as I'm writing about that, I see it. Or if I'm writing about things that make cattle balk. Some of the first work I ever did with cattle was to see that as they went through a chute, they'd stop if there was a coat on the fence. You can see how there's a reflection on this bottle. A reflection on a shiny car would make them balk. And nobody else noticed that. And when I first did my work with cattle in the early 70s, I didn't know other people were not visual thinkers. I thought everybody thought in pictures. I go, why don't the other people see that the cattle are seeing this truck and they're stopping? But I noticed all those little visual distractions. Now, as I discuss this, I'm seeing some of my PowerPoint slides right now, but I'm also seeing some trips I went on to, because I always get asked if cattle know they're going to get slaughtered. I've been to three places now, and I'm seeing them now as little video clips where paper towels hanging out of a dispenser like this was slowing down the cattle, and they were afraid to walk up the chute because of paper towels hanging out.
From the cow's perspective,
I'm seeing the paper towels. I can see them from my perspective, also from the cow's perspective, and I'm seeing them in three different points.
Right, but the point is those two perspectives, you're understanding why the cow is reluctant to move.
Yeah, the paper towels is barely moving like that.
But it's disturbing to the cow, which you are seeing.
But I'm seeing it, and I'm seeing where I'm standing right now in the paper towel, where it was, and something that little, thing that moves, it just makes them stop.
So let's stick with that. So there's the cow and the paper towel. Is there something like if you were to write about that instead of describing it as you are right now, is there some sort of narration that you can access?
Write about it. I'm saying people always ask me, are cattle afraid of getting slaughtered? And I'll say, well, they'll stop at little distractions such as a paper towel hanging out of a dispenser is moving slightly. Now, as I write that, I'm seeing that paper towel. I can even name the plant that was in.
So you're almost.
I'm not going to write that down, but.
No, but in a way, you're almost taking dictation from your movies.
That's right. I'm describing, one thing I've been really good at doing is writing directions on how to do stuff, because as I write it, I'm seeing.
Yeah.
I'm narrating the pictures in my head.
And when you were a young woman, which again is where those articles really put you on the map that then gave you the opportunity to design those systems, was that how it was working back then?
Well, that's right. And another thing Mother talked about was, you know, the little kid could learn concepts like up, down, on, or under.
Right, prepositions.
And the way I have to learn something like up, down, on, or under is with a bunch of specific examples. She talked about in the 50s we had these air raid drills and we had to go underneath the tables. Well, you could also get under a blanket. That'd be another example of under. Or I put the dish soap under the sink.
Right.
You see, I went up the stairs. I put a cup up on the shelf. A plane flew up in the air. See, to teach these position words, you have to give several different examples of up, down, under, and on to start teaching this concept of those different positions.
But her point seemed to be that that was an area, prepositions generally were an area you really struggled with, and that it took something like the air raid drills to really get the idea of under.
What you have to do to teach that is have multiple examples of up, under, and on. Okay, I put the water bottle on the table. I sat on a chair. Now, we talk about going on an airplane. Well, I'm now visualizing me on top of the plane while it's taking off. That would not...
Yeah.
That would be extremely bad.
Yeah. Well, there's a comedian named George Carlin
who famously...
But
they always say getting on an airplane.
Yeah.
And that's actually wrong. It's in an airplane.
This guy, George Carlin, you would have hit it off beautifully. Yeah.
But you have to give, I'm telling teachers, give, you know, 5 or 6 different specific examples of each one of those, I call them position words, because that makes better sense, of words like under, on, beside, up, down. Because if you just talk about going down the stairs, then the kid might think down only applies to stairs. But down applies to, I sat down in a chair. I walked down a hill. Those would be other examples of down. I'd give 5 or 6 different examples of each one of those position words. Yeah. Then they'll start to understand.
Is it tougher, a preposition, something like that, tougher than for someone who is a visual thinker? Because...
Well, actually, for me, I could understand it, you know, as soon as I got different examples of it.
Okay,
see,
so
what you have
examples,
to do, I'm a bottom-up thinker. So what you have to do to teach concepts is load the database with a lot of specific examples.
Okay.
Then I can start to sort those specific examples into categories. For example, when I was a little kid, I sorted cats, dogs, and horses by size. That worked fine until a dachshund came in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So then
very
what I had
cat-like.
To do
yeah.
is I had to figure out why the dachshund was not a cat.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then I started looking at different features that dachshunds share with dogs, such
right.
as barking. Her smell was the same as a dog.
Yeah.
You see sensory-based features of characteristics that dachshunds share with dogs that they don't share with cats.
All right, that's Dr. Temple Grandin in the final portion for today of the interview I recorded with her earlier this month at the Paramount Theater in Austin. So we'll hear the balance of the interview with Dr. Grandin and probably the Q&A section. I still haven't quite decided on that. I mean, there's some really good, important questions that came up, including some from people who themselves are on the spectrum. So I'm leaning towards including. It's just that at first the mics weren't working, and then periodically people who were up on the balcony, it was a packed house of 1,200 people, and didn't have mics up there. So they were shouting questions because they, of course, wanted to speak with Dr. Grandin too. So we did field those, and I did try to do what I could to sort of boost the audio. But anyways, it's not great quality audio, but I still may go ahead, like I say, just because I think most of the questions that came up in the conversations and of course, her answers were terrific. So either way, we'll hear the balance of the interview proper next week on Talking Animals. And thanks, got some nice email messages about the interview, which I appreciate. So in a few moments, I'll play a vintage eel song, which may have elements of an animal tune. So it could be a twofer, animal song, animal band. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. We're going to hear something from Matt Bronger, who periodically offers lovely and whimsical animal comedy pieces. This one is called Panda Butler from Matt Bronger in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Do you guys know what the secret is? It's a book that was trumpeted by Oprah that is very big in Los Angeles, very big with actor spiritualists, I like to call them, which is basically when you just want the universe to give you everything you want in a really selfish manner, and you want to be a star, you want to be an Entertainment Weekly, and you pray for the wrong things. That's all that is. But I'm not knocking it. Look, I think positive visualization is a handy tool, and it's good. It's good to stay positive. When you're negative all the time, it doesn't help you at all. But I don't necessarily believe in the secret, but I don't know. It might work. Asking the universe for something might work. So I'm going to try it right now. I'm going to try the secret and see if it works, okay? So I am going to throw out right now what I want from the universe and hope that I get it. So here we go, okay? Panda butler! That's all I want. I want a panda that is also a butler. That's it. I want a panda that walks on his hind legs and often fails and tries to be my butler. Walks in while I'm watching TV with a tray of champagne flutes, which he will drop. Granted, he will drop them, but he'll try. Walks in. It's okay, Clive. You're still my man. High five. Actually, any bear that won't kill me. That's all I want, right? I will rubberize my home wherever he wants, right? Just as long as he does. Like, can you imagine just sitting and watching TV with a bear that is also sitting and his little belly is going up and down with his breathing? His bear belly. You can put stuff on it, like a tray of cheese and crackers, and he occasionally just yells and you love it because it feels like commentary, right? You're right, dude. Jersey Shore is the end of all civilization. High five.
That was Matt Bronger with a piece called Panda Butler, taken from his album Shovel Fighter. Now it's time to turn to the Eels with a song I haven't played or even heard in many moons. I think it qualifies on one level or another as an animal tune. This is Fly Swatter on Talking Animals on WMNF. The Eels with Fly Swatter on Talking Animals on WMNF. We're just about the tail end of today's edition. Coming up at 11, or just after 11, after the NPR News headlines, we will be bringing you special live coverage of the Michael Cohen hearings, so stay tuned for that. And then at 2 p.m., the music kicks back in with Jennifer Hollowell, who's guest hosting today for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music, so that's going to be great. Be sure to tune in for her. I'm Duncan Strauss. We have just about reached the end of today's session of Talking Animals. Again, we'll be playing the balance of the Temple Grandin interview, perhaps a Q&A session as well on next week's show. So I invite you to join me next week for that. I also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast, iTunes podcast, or over there too. Also links to our Facebook page, Twitter feed, Instagram, etc. So please like us on Facebook, follow some of those other things. And you can also subscribe to our weekly little e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. NPR News headlines are next, and then the coverage of the Michael Cohen hearings. Thanks.